Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, cats and dogs, infants and toddlers, and other pairs of both related and semi-related things. Welcome to the show. My name is Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy, a show where I promote peace in such a way it ironically makes people want to kill me.
We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche, but here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Nervously saying words, fiddle surprising bed.
Good day. Good to have you listening. Thank you. I appreciate it. I hope you all are having a wonderful week. If for any reason you'd like to contact me, maybe to tell me how awesome I am or how horrible I am, or maybe you simply disagree with something I say and you'd like to take it up with me, you can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. And if you'd like to check out past episodes or look up information about some of the episodes or see some links to some outside resources to read up on, you can go to the website at www.christianarchy.net. And if you haven't yet and you like stupid memes like I do, you can check out the meme tab on the homepage. So today is one of those podcasts that I'm ill-prepared to do that I hope will be short and concise and to the point, maybe about 25 minutes long. But in the past, a lot of these episodes that I hoped would be brief ended up being 45 minutes long, which is lucky for you, you're welcome, but not quite as lucky for me. What I want to talk about today is what I'm actually proposing people do in order to move toward a free society. So far, while I've talked about some practical things in the case of a free society, and I've given a boatload of ethical reasons and I think biblical reasons for opposing the initiation of violence inherent in government, I haven't actually talked about or haven't talked much about how we could actually get there. What are some ways I think we might try to free the world from the oppression of government? Sometimes when people hear the word anarchist, they think violent people who just want to see the world burn, who engage in property destruction and kill people and steal things and who draw red A's all over the place. I'm sure there are some disgruntled teenage punk rockers who haven't really looked into the philosophy much and think the word sounds cool, who just want to use the word to describe themselves, who would engage in this kind of mob-like activity were it to erupt around them. But if you're a listener to this podcast or have any idea who I am in person, then you know I wouldn't support such a thing. Lots of people, however, do support violent revolutions against government. Most of the people I have seen talk about such things, and to be clear, they aren't actually making plans to do it or anything like that. They're just talking about it as a potential future hypothetical. Most of them aren't anarchists at all. They're usually what people would classify as right-wing extremist, which I guess some people classify me as that, but they are right-wing extremists in kind of the Republican Party mindset who want to take their country back. But they don't want to take their country back and institute a free society in its place. They just want their type of government getting back to traditional values, whatever that happens to mean, and it means different things to different people. I think they would think about themselves as creating a new nation which represented the same ideas that the founders had when they created the, although given most of their present politics, I don't think they've read their founders very much. I'm sure there are some anarchists who talk about violent revolution, but they aren't the ones I know. And nor do I think I would closely associate with anyone planning such a revolution, not just for my own safety, but because I wouldn't really want to be part of that or be have people think that I was a part of that, even though some people do anyway. I do understand this desire to violently overthrow the government, especially when it comes from people who take an honest look at the government and see how it actually functions, which are usually anarchists. The government is an inherently aggressively violent institution, Anyone who has seen this and experienced it for a while has really suffered under their overwhelming power. It's frustrating and dehumanizing to have people, even if they are people who have formed an organization called the government, using their violent power to force obedience and threatening death for non-compliance. I think a lot of times government's oppressive nature is actually easier when you are still in the Matrix. I just saw that movie, so it is inspiring some of the way I think about myself and pursuing the abolition of the state. When people still think that government is an ethical and good institution, it's actually easier to experience their mistreatment of you and not think anything of it. I have noticed, at least for myself, it's harder to experience that now because I see it for what it is. And when you're watching them destroy people's lives in the world repeatedly and hinder humanity over and over and over again, it becomes really disheartening. And people can come to feel, I think every anarchist at some point feels hopeless and helpless. What can we do? How can we possibly end this evil institution? How can we possibly live free while these people threaten us with death for the most minor of what they would call infractions and what we would call living in voluntary relationships? So there's a desire that can build to do something about it, even to lash out or to strike back, either for revenge or as an act of desperation to make a difference in the world, to be a positive force for good in the world. Being violently oppressed definitely fills many with indignation and the desire to overthrow the oppressors using whatever force is necessary. So I am sympathetic to the longing to overthrow the government using even violent means. There are lots of potential problems which would arise with a violent revolution. One of them is simply that historically there have been many violent overthrows of government, and they've almost always, or have always, I'm not sure, I'm not a history expert, nor do I know if anyone knows, but they have at least almost always led to another government being put in its place. Not necessarily a worse government, it can often be a relatively better government, but you still have the same problem of an evil institution replacing another evil institution. Slightly less evil is a positive movement, but it's not really what we're going for, and I don't think it's worth having a violent revolution to institute something that's evil, but just less so. And then there's the problem of why are people revolting? I think if you were going to lead a violent revolution against the U.S. government, there would be millions of people, at least eventually, who would be willing to participate in it with you, at least under the right circumstances. But many of them would not be doing so because they are like anarchists are. They oppose the initiation of violent force on peaceful people. It would be maybe because they wanted power, or because they wanted to institute a better government, or they wanted revenge, or they just liked violence, or they thought that somehow they could personally benefit from this overthrow, rather than doing it for ethical reasons. And in any violent overthrow, there's going to be a lot of people dying and a lot of wealth destroyed. I think we can do it better than that. I think we can find a way to not kill people and not destroy so much property, which will lead to, or can lead to, the betterment of the world, and instead do so peacefully and gradually. In addition to these things, one of the problems is that a sudden collapse of the government would be highly problematic. And I will talk a little bit about why I think that is later on in this episode. At least I hope I remember to talk about why a sudden collapse of the state would be a really bad thing. So, I am not promoting a violent overthrow. You hear that? NSA Nancy, DHS Danny, Law Enforcer Lou, or FBI Mike? threw a curveball at you there. I bet you thought I was going to be FBI Frank or Freddy. Nope. Turns out I am capable of talking without deliberately using alliteration. So not only do I not promote a violent overthrow, I discourage it for a lot of reasons, both ethical and practical. Overall, I think attempting or even taking into serious consideration a violent overthrow of the state will not be helpful to our cause. Even if it's successful, quote-unquote, we'll end up with another state and a bunch of people who think differently, who don't oppose violent oppression, who see an opportunity in the destabilization of the world, and so themselves try to, and probably succeed, at least in some places, violently take power and rule over people anyway. There are a few ways I can imagine us moving peacefully from a government-run society, a tyrannical society, to a peaceful and free society. The first step in any of these ways is a shift in perspective of large numbers of the population. For any hope of actually moving toward a better world without government, what we need are people like me to actually be somewhat successful in convincing other people to reject initiating violent force on others. I anticipate there being a slow shift in perspective over the course of many years, hopefully sped up a lot by the government and by the consistency of the principles. As I've said before, I use that phrase a lot because I repeat myself a lot and I hate repeating myself. But, you know, you can't say new things all the time. In fact, I rarely do. The foundation for rejecting government as unethical is simply applying personal ethics that 99% of the population already agrees with. Applying those ethics consistently. Don't hurt people. Don't take their stuff. And don't lie and commit fraud to force someone into a position they would not otherwise choose to be in. Pretty much everyone you know agrees with this in their daily life. Almost no one in the world would find it acceptable if another person did one of these things to them. They would know and feel like an injustice had been done, like they had been wrong. But they don't apply these to government, because if they did, if we did, we would see that it violates all of these things. The system of government exists through physically hurting people, taking their stuff, and defrauding them through deception and not following through on their promises. If government were a person, we would tell our kids, do not act like that. That is a negative object lesson of how to be a horrible human being in the world and how to treat others wrongly, consistently, all the time. For being such a simple concept, consistently applying ethics is surprisingly a difficult task. It's daunting to try to figure out how to get people to consistently apply those ethics. But I do follow a big and powerful God who I am confident wants the world to be a better and more just place to live. A God who created humans free and created humans to have voluntary interactions with each other. Who made the world where all are equal, where no one was designed to rule over other people, and who hates violence and would like less of it. That God who I believe wants these things to happen and who will bring these things eventually, as we talked about Revelation last week. That same God is working with me and his people to bring us from where we are to someplace better. The same thing he does with all of us individually, I believe he is doing and will continue doing with the world collectively, meeting us where we're at, and then convicting us and empowering us to make our relationships, our systems, and the world we live in a better place to live than what it is today. And once we're in government, I think God will bring us to something else after that. I think the abolition of slavery is kind of a helpful thing to think about when thinking about the abolition of the state. Not that slavery is actually ended. Slavery still happens way too much in the world, and it's horrible and evil, and I don't want to pretend like it's not still a problem, but I am very glad that I do not know anyone personally who would be willing to say that he supports slavery because he thinks it's ethical. This transition from a place to slavery being widespread across the globe for most of recorded human history to it being something that most people influenced by Western culture, at least across the globe, find to be abhorrent, didn't come about through a violent revolution. It wasn't because there were a few ethicists like me who were ahead of their time and took up arms, fighting against all slave owners and all who supported slavery. This would have been futile. Surely these people who opposed slavery, despite living in a world of others who supported it, existed, but it wasn't enough for just a handful of people to oppose it. What had to happen is that a rejection of the system as ethical had to spread so that there were enough people to make a real change. This is the same sort of journey that myself and other anarchists are on. There's a handful of us who are united in purpose without any sort of power except the power of the truth and the power of ethical consistency and the power of insisting on treating humanity like humans. And for some of us, like me, hopefully the power of the Spirit of God working within me and working on hearts to convict the world to treat others better. So in my ideal world, there would be a quick education of the entire population of the U.S., because that's where I live right now, so that's where I'm most concerned about at the moment, just because I have most influence over my proximity. So people would realize the truth about the nature of government and would apply ethics consistently and want voluntary relationships rather than coercive ones with their fellow human beings. And then there would be a progressive and gradual dissolution of the federal government, leading to a dissolution of the state and local governments. And as this happens, a gradual replacement of necessary services the government provides now would happen with other private individuals and private companies. So at no point where the government is dissolving would there be a time when people needed something government provided now and did not have the ability to access it. That's the ideal utopian vision that I don't think is possible, but people still pursue it or claim to pursue it. One guy, Adam Kokesh, is running for president in the year 2020 as an anarchist. His platform is the peaceful elimination of the federal government. And I think that he's doing this a lot because he wants to spread the message of freedom and nonviolence to many people in hopes that a large enough platform, a large enough presidential campaign might actually spread the message better than someone like me, for example. The hope is that with the national government eliminated, state governments would more easily be able to transition into free regions of the country where there were not people ruling over other people. So I guess he considers the peaceful dissolving of governments to be idyllic also. He just has more ambition than me and is trying to do something about it, whereas I just talk about it. Another thing that I think could be effective to move toward a free society or to have at least free regions in a society is for anarchists to come together into one spot to localize in geographic regions and grow in influence in their local governments and grow in ability to survive with each other and relate to one another voluntarily in various areas. And then eventually when there were enough of them and they were big enough and self-sustaining enough, they could simply ignore the government and say, we don't consent to you ruling over us. You have no right to. We don't recognize your laws as legitimate or binding or ethical or anything that we need to follow. And so we're declaring our independence officially and then live without the government there. And I think with enough people, it has the potential to be quite effective, especially if it's done in multiple areas at once. And there is an organization that, while this is not their stated goal, I think they actually have some hope of succeeding at doing this. It's called the Free State Project. And this is a group for libertarians or liberty lovers, not necessarily anarchists, even though many of them are, where they're trying to get a bunch of people who have similar principles, especially the non-aggression principle is usually universal in that group of people. It's just some of them don't apply it consistently yet. Hopefully they all will soon. The attempt is to get people to move to New Hampshire to influence the government there. What the plan is to have 20,000 libertarians pledge to move there. And then once 20,000 pledge, once they get to that number, I think they're at like 18,000 something right now. I don't keep up on it that much. Then that will trigger the move so that within the next 2 years, all the people that pledge to move will move there. And then they'll have influence over the state and local governments in order to use the current system in place, even though it's evil, in order to make the current evil government system less powerful and have less influence and achieve the most amount of freedom they can. Now, they've already had some success in decreasing the number of laws and decreasing government there. And they do some kind of cool stuff, like when they get a traffic ticket, they always fight it in order to try to flood the court system as much as possible so that they can't prosecute as many cases, especially for things like nonviolent crimes. I think that this movement has the potential to change enough of the laws and to grow the movement enough and localize the movement enough that there could be an eventual secession of New Hampshire from the United States government. After this, I would think that most of the people there, because of the people there who are the major influencers, I think that most of the people there would seek to then dissolve the New Hampshire government. They would probably secede formally as a U.S. state, and then after that move into dismantling the government they still had in place as a state. I don't know how it would work necessarily. That's just how I imagine it's most likely to go if it happens at all. And this would lead to a very interesting interaction, although potentially lethal and evil interaction, between the U.S. military and the people of New Hampshire to see, one, whether or not the government would say, we're going to go in and forcibly make the people of New Hampshire become a part of the United States again, and two, if they did say that, if the people of the military would be so willing to kill U.S. citizens, or at least former U.S. citizens who weren't hurting anyone. And then the social media response to that would be insane if they were actually going to do that, or who would support it, who wouldn't. Some military members would probably go to New Hampshire and defend them. I don't know. As always, I hope it would turn out peacefully. That is what I try to be as much about as I know how to, even though I fail sometimes. There is also some, I think they're anarchists, at least some people involved are anarchists and talk like anarchists, who are hoping to create a free society outside of the state through seasteading. This is using modern technology, forming big, giant boat cities that can connect with one another, putting them out in the middle of the ocean where no one really reigns, where there's no government that claims ownership over all the land in the ocean, and then saying, we own this and the area around this, and being quite a large, really, I mean, in the tens of thousands is easily conceivable, a decent-sized city floating in the middle of the ocean without any sort of formal government or anything like that. The technology isn't quite there yet to make this a possibility for even your average middle-class American, but like most technology, it's something that hopefully can be much more attainable in the next 10 to 20 years, where this could be a legitimate possibility. Not something I want to do, though. I have nothing really against the sea, but I am partial to land. That's all I really have that I think are viable that I want to talk about, at least. And I'm sure there are more potential ways of peacefully transitioning to a free society. But for now, at least for me, the most important part is getting people to reject the violence of the state as legitimate or an ethical way to organize society. It's convincing people to oppose the idea that they have some sort of right to, whether directly or through the government, that they have some sort of right to violently force others to obey their will. It essentially comes down to a rejection of the idea that one group has a right to preemptively act violently upon another. And I think this sort of gradual and peaceful and progressive transition would be the best way to go. I don't want to see the state just suddenly end, even though I kind of do, and I think it would, after a couple of years, be a lot better than what we have now. But the sudden transition would be very difficult, even chaotic. A sudden collapse, whether caused by the government itself, just as an implosion or a violent overturning by people, will be what most people think of as anarchy. It'll be chaotic and hectic and violent, and there will be theft and destruction, and murder rates will increase, and people will use their violent strength to control other people who aren't doing that now. I think there will be many people rushing in to exert power over others. Many people want power and think they do good things with it or think it would benefit them a lot. And panicked people who have had the state just fall out from underneath their feet want hope and help and will be inclined to listen to anyone who makes the claims that they can provide help for them, as they are now with government. They will be with influential and charismatic and violently powerful people if the government were to suddenly collapse. Some people call this a power vacuum, as if government is necessary and someone needs to be ruling over other people. Otherwise, you have a vacuum where there isn't one powerful organization ruling over people in a given region, as if people have some sort of inherent need to be violently ruled, as if people can't function without one group who threatens them with violence to coerce obedience. I know you guys are better than that. Most people I know are better than that. But they are sometimes under this deception that without government, there will be a power vacuum which will then go to create a new government. I would propose a different way of thinking about it. There is a vacuum created that creates significant issues in the world which leave people at least temporarily more vulnerable to being ruled more directly by other people. But I would call this vacuum a services vacuum rather than a power vacuum. What's missing, what creates the chaos through its absence, is not the violent oppression of the state. It is the absence of essential services that the state provides that people need. Think about Walmart as an example and the things that they do now. They sell food, they have a pharmacy, they sell clothing, they sell car tires and things you need for your vehicle, household goods, lights, all sorts of things. Again, sometimes I get obsessed with lists and I just start listing things off. I think that somehow talking about the items that Walmart has would make a really good and interesting podcast. It turns out it's really just me playing games with myself, seeing how many things I can name from Walmart, which is rarely a fun game. I don't think Hasbro is going to pick it up anytime soon. Anyway, Walmart has a lot of things. They provide a lot of jobs for different people. So what if they went suddenly bankrupt? It would be really bad. It would be negative for a lot of people's lives who shop there and find similar products for cheaper there and benefit from their lower prices. And it would be bad for the people who work there and the people who sell them products and the people who make products for the people who sell them products. It would have a lot of negative economic effects, but it wouldn't be that bad. It wouldn't be chaotic. It wouldn't create a services vacuum because I can go to Walmart to get groceries and I can go to 40 other stores within 15 miles from my house to get groceries if I need to. I can go to Walmart to get tires, or I can go to 20 other businesses to get tires. I can go to Walmart to get pharmaceutical drugs necessary for my survival, or I can go to the pharmacy down the street to get the same drugs necessary for my survival. So while it would be bad and have negative effects, it wouldn't create chaos if they suddenly collapsed. It would just make some people's lives more difficult. But what if the nature of Walmart was different? What if Walmart was the only store in the whole United States that sold groceries? What if it was the only place people could get their medical items and medical drugs? What if just these two things were something Walmart had a monopoly on, and no one else provided them, no one else had the same relationships with vendors or wholesalers or distribution patterns throughout the U.S. and plans like this, and then Walmart crashed? Now that would create chaos and havoc, and there'd be violence and looting and rioting, mob mentalities, and people would be murdered and people would die from lack of resources. It would be a huge and destructive mess in the world. In this case, if Walmart was a government, people would call it a power vacuum because of the results that happened when they collapse. But Walmart doesn't rule over other people. They don't have violent power that they use to rule over other people in this case. What it is it's a services vacuum. And services vacuums are created when there are monopolies on essential and necessary services for society. So if you have government services collapse like food stamps, security, or arbitration, or money, or roads for distribution, or the welfare state, if this stuff suddenly collapses, yes, there's chaos, but it's because they have a monopoly in providing these services, not because people have an inherent need to have other people threaten them with violence. Otherwise, they just don't know how to act. The problem is the monopoly, and that's part of the reason why we need to have, or we should have, a market in some of the essential services government has. That way, if one of the companies or providers collapses and goes out of business, there isn't chaos and havoc and death and murder and looting. There's some bad things that happen to people economically, and other people find a different company to get that essential service from. The monopoly creates the services vacuum, which creates the chaos. It's not a need to be ruled. It's a need for some of the things government provides for society in conjunction with a learned dependence on the state because they are the only providers and have marketed themselves and made themselves the only providers of some of the essential services that we would have were it not for the coercive monopoly of government. So I've told you about what I want to happen and some of the reasons why I don't want there to be a sudden and immediate collapse of the state. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about what I think will actually end up happening. It's not very positive, but I think we can land lightly with some preparation. And many anarchists are at the forefront of preparing the world for a softer landing. The most likely way, in my opinion, and in many people's opinion, but you're listening for mine right now, I would think if you're listening to hear someone else's opinion, this is the wrong podcast for you for sure. In my opinion, the most likely way for the government to end is through an economic collapse, specifically the collapse of the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar has lost at least 96% of its value since 1913. For a lot of reasons, this is a tough thing to actually measure, which if you ever want me to get into, I can, but it's super boring economic stuff. But based on the numbers available using different ways of measuring it, I can say with quite a bit of confidence that a 96% decrease in value over the last 103 years is the minimal amount the dollar has lost. The trend of the value of the dollar continues over on a year-to-year basis. It varies from day-to-day and week-to-week and month-to-month sometimes. But on a year-to-year basis, it continues to go down and down and down and decrease in value. And this is because it has nothing substantive backing it up. Eventually, it's going to lose so much value that it won't be worth anything, or it will be worth so little it's almost impossible to use it efficiently. When this happens, people will have no idea how to trade with one another or pay for anything or engage in economic interactions. Farmers will still be making food, but they won't have anyone to buy it from them, or they won't have any, the people who want to buy it from them won't have anything of value to the farmer to purchase it, because everything they did have, wealth in the form of dollars, will be worth nothing or next to nothing. I think that this is something that will probably happen in my lifetime, but lots of people have been predicting this for decades, so I don't know. I don't have a solid timeline, and I don't want to be a panic starter or anything like that. I don't think overreacting is a good thing. At the same time, I do think that in the next couple decades, it is a very likely scenario. One thing that anarchists do to try to overthrow the government, actually, when they talk about this, they talk about it as an underthrowing of the government, is engage in agorism. And agorism is basically living freely in voluntary relationships with other people while being under the state, while still being in the region the state claims to rule, but living free regardless. Agorists engage in what is often called counter-economics, which is economic activity, voluntary transactions, maybe involving money or maybe just involving trading things that are outside of the purview of government. Maybe this means dealing with illegal things like drugs or guns or untaxed labor or growing things without a permit, anything that's under the table and hidden from government, or things even that are legal but untaxable. In terms of transactions, these are the kinds of things agorists engage in, and they call it counter-economics. Another thing that agorists want to do is to replace the essential services of the state, even while the state still exists, so that they can function without the state while still having everything that the state would otherwise give them if they were functioning with it. So they're concerned about things like how to have a system of voluntary trade with one another. How do we exchange goods and services and land and stuff like that with one another, engaging in voluntary, mutually beneficial economic relationships? So one of the things that agorists do is seek to have an alternative currency on hand and to use that in their interactions with other people. Something like gold and silver, which historically, as long as we can tell, have always had value to humans. So they have that as a means of trading easily with one another, because it's much easier to trade in small items that are worth a lot, like gold and silver, than to bring 10 barrels of apples to pay someone to do your dry cleaning or something like that. Another alternative form of currency is called Bitcoin, and I've been using this a little bit, and it's been quite a pleasurable and helpful and money-saving experience for me, and it's just kind of nice to have some resources that I can use quite easily on the internet without having to deal in U.S. dollars. And other than just a currency, Agorists seek to acquire abilities and services and food, tools, and other goods that are practical for exchanging with other people outside of the state. Many agorists are kind of your off-the-grid type people, those that want to create a self-sustaining home or farm or forest with heat and electricity and the ability to make clothing and have food on one piece of property without needing to go anywhere else to have basic needs for everyone living there met. I appreciate this. It's very practical. There's nothing immoral about it, but personally, I'd rather live around a larger group of people. And it's not going to lead to the highest standard of living because the division of labor allows for a much more efficient and wealthy society so that people focus on doing what they're good at and then exchanging with others who do what they're good at in a totally different area. And it leads to the maximization of production, which is the maximization of the standard of living and continued expansion of the economy, which eventually, as I've talked about before, I believe can and at some point will lead to the poorest person in the world being able to afford a yacht. And I like that idea because that means no one starves to death or dies because they can't afford healthcare or anything like that. Another thing agorists do is seek to provide security services underneath the state without having to call the police officers or the military in because they already have that sort of thing taken care of and looked after. And they might do this personally by putting an alarm system on their house or putting up a fence or barriers or having firearms to fight off any potential intruders. They might do this communally where they have relationships with their neighbors and they are always in conversation with one another about strange people entering their homes and keeping an eye out for property violators, where they have an agreement to work together to minimize that in their community. There's also some people who are working on making apps which allow people to say when they need help and then to have their neighbors also have the app and the alarm goes off on their phone and then they can go to the address to help them with whatever it is. It happens to be all this stuff is sort of agorist activity, providing the essential services of security without the state. And I think eventually what these security services will look like, even underneath the state, if these communities grow large enough, is a community getting together to voluntarily fund security services, but getting together on accident. No one can afford, very few people can afford, to have a private security guard at their house at all times. They certainly can't afford to be the only customer of an entire security company. But at the same time, I can't afford to build, maintain, and hire employees for a McDonald's either. But I can still go to one whenever I want to, basically, because they exist all around the country, because people accidentally, voluntarily get together to fund McDonald's because they all want it individually, but it's collectively funded. I think that that is the way security services will work in a free society. This brings me to a conversation about violence. I have talked about this before. I am a former pacifist turned minimal violencist. Violencist? Kind of like that. I don't know what word to use. And I know that there are a lot of anarchists who are also pacifists, and thank you, good for you, for being consistent with your pacifism, because a lot of pacifists, even in some articles I've read lately, there are people who claim that Christians should not use violence on any other person, and then say they should just get the government to use violence for them, which is silly, and I find it really weird that I live in the world where that's what people do, and hardly anyone ever calls them out on it. I do not oppose people using violence in self-defense. I do think Christians are called to enemy love and to avoid vengeance and to love the victim and the perpetrator equally. But if you love both of them equally, you'll still, I think, prevent the perpetrator from harming the victim. This doesn't mean you don't love the perpetrator, because if the circumstances were different involving the same people where the person who's the victim were going to harm the perpetrator, you would respond in the same way, protecting the perpetrator from the victim. I believe you can both love someone and use force to prevent them from harming another person. Honestly, I'm not sure how to protect the poor and the weak without the willingness to use violence on some occasions, or how to have a functioning society without the use of defensive force, because if 99% of people weren't willing to use defensive force in a society, you could just have the 1% ruling over them and controlling them, because they would have rendered themselves helpless. I'm not convinced by the handful of pretty decent biblical arguments which exist against violence. I think it's a really lot to put on a few verses, and there are some strained conclusions from a few passages, in my opinion, that don't need to be interpreted as it's always wrong to use violence in every circumstance. I would defend people and their property from those who would aggressively violate them if I thought I could do so ethically. And I think by pursuing a free society, even if I am mistaken about not being a pacifist, pursuing a free society will move us to a much more minimal usage of violence. So when I talk about security services, I do anticipate them using defensive force to protect people and their property. Along with this, I wanted to say a friend of mine asked me to talk more about violence, and I said I already did. So I asked him to have a conversation about it. Actually, I'm not sure if he asked me to have a conversation about it with him or if he just wanted me to talk about more. I can't remember. But me and this friend are kind of at a similar place when it comes to our ideas about violence and when we think it's just and unjust to use it and what we think the Bible says about it. So I would be really interested in having a three-way conversation recorded for the podcast with me and him and someone else who is a complete nonviolent pacifist to have a discussion about that and figure out where we disagree. And maybe you can convince me to see things from your perspective when it comes to that. So if you're someone that feels like they can talk real good, or at least you're courageous enough to talk in a mediocre manner with other people like me who aren't necessarily that good at talking either. I just am doing it a lot lately, so maybe I'm improving. But you can contact me, jeremiahjm@gmail.com, and maybe we can figure out a time to record something that would be a valuable conversation people would like to listen to about violence and if it's ever okay for Christians to use it. All right, back to agorism. Another thing that agorists do, which people do anyway outside of agorism, is to provide charities. Right now, the government functions to do some provision for the poor and the people who can't take care of themselves and the people who, I would argue, can take care of themselves, but choose not to because it's easier to get stuff for free. Not that that's everyone or even the majority, I'm not sure, of the people who use government assistance, but it is a good chunk of the ones I've met. So agorists seek to provide communities and charities and groups of mutual cooperation to help provide for those people who need help provided for them, as well as to help them not just eat and have a place to sleep and have clothing and water, but also help them move from point A to point B, where they can help them progress so that they are a person who figures out how they can work to fill their needs, which I believe is a humanizing and life-bringing experience, even though Even though a lot of times I'd rather just lay on the couch and watch football, I actually believe that work is good. In a free society, I think that most people giving to a charity would really want to see this charity focus on improving people's lives and helping people, at least those who can, become more capable. While underneath the government, this doesn't happen anywhere near as much as it would with voluntarily funded charities. Finally, one other government service that agorists seek to provide is systems of arbitration. How to solve disputes between people who have disagreements about property, or maybe they think a crime has been committed, or maybe they think someone has misled them or defrauded them or not followed through on their contract or stolen something from them or something like that, where people have a problem with other people because they believe they've been wronged. And there needs to be something in place, some sort of third party other than those two or more people deciding whether or not person A was wronged by person B. And this could be in the form of private courts or private companies known for deciding between individuals who have really good systems in place to determine who is in the right and who is in the wrong, or in how much each person is correct and what the proper compensation would be for these things. Or maybe it's just individuals who are in a small community who are known for their objectivity and fairness, compassion, integrity, and wisdom, who can solve disputes and come to wise decisions that both parties would agree to adhere to ahead of time. I believe I'll talk more in 2 months about a potential justice system in a free society, within which I'll talk more about arbitration systems and the like. So those are some of the services agorists seek to establish while under the government rule. By establishing some of these systems, by having things like a different form of money, self-sustaining homes, security services, arbitration systems, ways of distributing stuff and trading, by having these things without government already in place, when the government collapses, which will happen eventually, it happens to every government, there will be less chaos, less violence, less looting, less robbery and destruction because of anarchy. Because of those anarchists who choose to engage in free behavior despite all the people who want to violently rule over them. I don't really do much of any agorism. I'm not really a good anarchist. I'm more of a pontificator than someone who puts my beliefs into actions. I think I would engage in more. I just need all my friends to reject the violence of the state first, and then we'll figure that stuff out. All right, I'm done. I cannot talk anymore. I don't know how long that podcast was, but I think it was way longer than I anticipated. Sorry if it got too rambly. At any rate, you all know that I appreciate you listening, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to process things. Rate the podcast on iTunes if you think it's worth rating. Share the podcast if you think it's worth sharing. And if you don't think it's worth any of those things, please, please, at least don't support government violence on peaceful people. You've been listening long enough that you know how absurd that is, right? Right? Okay. May your week be marked by the love and peace and courage of Christ.